True Seekers, Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. Glad you could make it. It's about 7 minutes past the hour. Tonight we're going to, at some point in the evening, we're going to start reading the series of mini-essays that are available in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, the June 2007 issue. Collectively, they're entitled Undoing Bush, How to Repair 8 Years of Sabotage, Bungling, and Neglect. And they're divided into specific categories, so at some point this evening we'll do the first one. We also have some musings from our favorite know-nothing, Foxy the Snowman, tonight to share with you on Bush's new war czar and the fate of one of the Bush crime family's consigliere, Paul Wolfowitz, who just doesn't seem to get it. You don't put your girlfriend on the payroll. You just don't. And make sure she jumps ahead of everybody else to get raises and expect to get away with it, unless you're a neocon jackass. Oops, but I repeat myself. Breaking news today. Did you see the breaking news? The head of the British Armed Forces, the commanding general, Lord Sir General whatever, has decided that Prince Harry will not go to Iraq and kill brown people. No, not going to do it. As Edie in Atlanta writes to me, the decision was made as much to protect his fellow soldiers as to protect the prince. So, consequently, poor Harry will be unable to carry on the proud British Empire tradition of traveling the globe in search of helpless people of the darker races to liberate from their very lives. And I'm sure Harry is all pissed off about this. I'd say I wanted to go kill him. Wanted to be with my mates and go kill him. Don't write to me about my lousy British accent. I don't have a British accent. I wonder, never mind. I was going to say something about the Bush twins, but never mind. The corruption in the past, what are we in? Year 7 now of government, of the regulatory agencies, of just about every branch of government, is almost 100% under the Bush crime family. I've issued the challenge over and over and over again to right-wingers, that would be all Republicans in the United States of America today, to tell me one thing that the Bush crime family has done that is beneficial to the American public, to the U.S. Constitution, to our safety and security, to the health and safety of American citizens, anything, just one thing. And I fully recognize that Republicans are cowards. Every single Republican in America is a coward, every one of them. And the more conservative they are, the more cowardly they become. That's why people like Chuck Hagel, even though he's a Republican, appears not to be cowardly, because he kind of slides to the liberal side of the spectrum on certain issues. But the more you get to the conservative side, the more cowardly, just brazenly cowardly you become. And knowing that, I don't expect these right-wingers to call this program with any sort of a coherent response to that challenge that I have put out there for the past 4 years now. But I do expect once in a while to get an email from these freaks. And even with it, because then they're safe. You know, I can't gut them if they send an email. Usually the emails I get from the right-wingers, when they do write, is full of misspelled profanity and attacks on my daughter or my wife or you know, the usual stuff you expect from a Republican. But the challenge still stands. If there's anything that this Bush administration has done that benefits the American public, that is not contrary to the law, whether it's constitutional law, international law, domestic law, or just common sense, I'd like to know what it is. There is nothing. Now, it is not just the Bush crime family. You know, when the head of the snake is vile and foul and does nasty things, the body follows along behind it, doesn't it? Think U.S. Senate. Now, for the greater part of Bush's reign, it has been controlled by Republicans. And as reported, where was it reported today? Hell, I don't even know. Is it New York Times? Someplace. Senators who raised millions of dollars in campaign donations from pharmaceutical interests, companies, worked their magic, the senators did, on a landmark drug safety bill that, for the most part, gutted the bill and put in place of consumer safety clauses, industry safety clauses. The bill passed 93-1. Now, the only one who voted against it, of course, the only one who voted against it is, what's his name from, oh, God, come on, Malloy, what the hell, don't go blank on me tonight. Bernie Sanders, the independent, the socialist from Vermont, he's the only one that voted against this foul, filthy bill. So if 93 senators voted yes, you know about half of them were Democrats. That's right. Huh? The bill passed 93-1. It grants the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, broad new authority to monitor the safety of drugs after they are approved. However, the powers that were granted to the FDA in the bill's original version were sliced and diced during private meetings among senators and, that's right, representatives of the pharmaceutical industry, and efforts to curb conflicts of interest among FDA advisors and allow consumers to buy cheaper drugs from other countries, that was soundly defeated in closed sessions, in close votes. Nah, the American public can go pound sand up one of its body orifices. Orifices. The energy industry, the pharmaceutical industry, they really have us by the short hairs, don't they? A measure that blocked an effort to allow drug importation passed 49-40. That means 49 senators said, no, we don't want drug importation because that'll make it too easy for the American consumer to afford drugs. So it passed. The measure blocked an effort to allow drug importation. In other words, what was defeated was, let me see, how to say this without upsetting right-wingers, the free market idea. Let the marketplace decide on the price. The 49 senators who voted against drug importation received about $5 million from industry executives and political action committees in the past 4 or 5 years. Nearly three-quarters of the industry donations to current members of the Senate. That's according to a USA Today analysis and the Center for Responsive Politics and Political Moneyline. They took a look at it. The senators who are most active in making sure that you and I are really not protected by the FDA are the very senators who receive the most money. Huh? You like that? Senator Pat Roberts, Republican of Kansas, said he demanded removal of language that would have allowed the FDA to ban advertising of high-risk drugs for 2 years because, Pat Roberts said, that will restrict free speech. So what Roberts is saying, the original bill would have allowed the FDA to ban advertising of drugs that may kill you. For 2 years, just 2 years. After the 2 years, then the makers of the drug could come on your television set and say, okay, you want to try Acme corn removers here. Even though we have a spotty history over the past 2 years, we've had 47 people die. don't worry about that. Just keep your eye on the little bouncing ball here. Pat Roberts said, no, we don't want that because it restricts free speech. Now, Roberts has raised thousands and thousands of dollars from drug interest so far this year, and records show that he has raised $66,000 from the drug industry since 2001. His spokeswoman said,
"Well, you know, Senator Roberts takes great pains to keep fundraising and official actions separate."
Senator Judd Gregg, Republican of New Hampshire. He says it was his authorship in the bill of a change that reduced the FDA's power to require post-market safety studies. Right? The drug comes out, the FDA approves it, and all of a sudden they discover something that's killing people. Judd Gregg had removed from the bill the power of the FDA to require further safety studies. So if a drug comes out and starts killing people, oops, sorry, well, you know, that's the magic of medicine. Just so happens. He said, Judd Gregg said he wanted to target drugs only if there was evidence of harm. How much has Gregg gotten from the pharmaceutical industry? $168,500 from drug executives and drug PACs since 2001. Now, what about Ed Kennedy? Uh-oh. Put that radio down. Don't ask me no questions.
Border to border and coast to coast, The Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse.
It's about 22 past the hour. All right. The senators who weakened this drug bill, this landmark drug safety bill, the story is the senators who helped weaken this bill got millions upon millions of dollars from the pharmaceutical industry. I wonder if it's beginning to sink in yet. I think Michael Moore's new movie, what's it called, Kathy? What is it called? Sicko. Yeah, I think Michael Moore's new movie is going to explore some of this when it comes out. But the fact that the pharmaceutical industry or the so-called pharmaceutical industrial complex in this country wields so much control over who lives and who dies, who gets medication and who doesn't, who's going to get well and who's going to remain sick, what diseases are attacked, just a frontal assault, and what diseases are not. You know, when I see television commercials, when I happen to be watching the news, the network news tonight, about something called restless leg syndrome, I want to kill something. You know, I just want to start smashing things up. When I see commercials about a new drug that treats people whose eyes produce or don't produce tears or something, you know, Jesus, God in heaven, there's Visine. It's been around for, what, 100,000 years? You know, when I see those kind of commercials, then I think about people who are really suffering from something, more complex, more painful, more life-threatening than restless leg syndrome. Calm down. I freak out. And then you have a situation like Vioxx, that whole Vioxx story. The people who allowed Vioxx on the market knew full well it was going to kill people. The pharmaceutical industry knew it was going to kill people. The people that put it out there knew it was going to kill people. But they figure, all right, how many people do you think are going to die? And their statisticians got to work and the actuaries got to work and said, well, it's going to be this amount of people times this amount of money. We'll be okay. We'll be okay. The profits on this are going to be so monstrous that, you know, if we have to pay, you know, $500 million in lawsuits, it's still worth it to go for it. What about the people who are dying? Oh, well, screw them. Screw them. It's horrifying. These stories go on and on. So now we find out that a so-called landmark drug safety bill has been gutted, has been turned effectively into mush. Judd Gregg, Republican in New Hampshire, takes credit for screwing it. Pat Roberts, Republican in Kansas, takes credit. Now, the bill's chief sponsors, Ed Kennedy of Massachusetts and Mike Enzi, Republican from Wyoming, the two of them agreed, after consultations with industry officials and others, to modify a proposal that all clinical drug studies be made public. Modify. That means all the clinical drug studies now will not be made public. Ah, but wait a minute. Ted Kennedy? No. Yes. Mike Enzi, the Republican from Wyoming, his spokesman, said that under the change, only those studies submitted to the FDA would be available. What does that mean? Only those studies submitted. So if a study is put together that is going to be peer-reviewed in JAMA or one of the other medical journals, now it will not. It will not be reviewed and put out for publication. The public is not to know. They will not be made public. Clinical drug studies. Now, Enzi, since 2001, he has taken $175,000 from drug interests. Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat, Massachusetts, $78,000 from the pharmaceutical industrial complex. Spokesman for both of these senators said the money did not influence them.
The man conservatives love to hate, it's Mike Malloy.
Oh, 26 before the hour. Every time I see a story like this about how this country is run by the corporations rather than by our elected officials, I really do get angry, especially where it concerns product safety, whether the product is cat food or the drugs we take for all the ills we get in this country because we don't have healthy lifestyles. Very few of us really do. And when you find out that I mean, it's no big secret, but when it's brought to one's attention the corruption of members of the Senate and ultimately some of them don't get quite as much House members. When the corruption is brought to your attention, at least in my case, I just sit here and wonder, what the hell? When did we lose control of our country? When did it get this bad? Now, I know during the Reagan years, that's when it was the most blatant up to that point. And certain parts of the press reported on the fact that regulatory laws were being written by the very industries whom the laws were supposed to encompass. And, some of them screamed and yelled. I was, starting a talk radio back then. I thought, oh, man, this is really terrible stuff. Nobody pays any attention, really, especially us voters. We just don't pay any attention. Why would Ted Kennedy? I don't care about Republicans. Republicans can all go straight to hell. They're all corrupt. They're all filthy. They're all no good. But Ted Kennedy, why would Ted Kennedy accept $78,000 from the pharmaceutical industrial complex? Why would he do that? Ted Kennedy has a lock. Ted Kennedy can be senator from Massachusetts until they're giving drinks of ice water in hell. He doesn't need the money to campaign. All he has to do every 6 years is stand up there and say, all right, I'm running again. That's it. The Republicans who accept money, that's what Republicans do. They are filthy. They are corrupt down to their soulless centers. But Ted Kennedy? Oh, well. Senators also voted down an amendment to this bill that would have made it harder, more difficult for scientists who have accepted money from a drug company to advise the FDA on drug approval applications from that firm. In other words, the bill as originally written, and maybe this is where Kennedy and Mike Enzi tried to make an effort. I doubt it, but maybe this is where. They wanted to say, look, if you're a scientist and you've gotten money from a drug company, then you cannot advise the FDA on drug approval about that drug or that company. I mean, is that not a definition of conflict of interest? That's been removed from the bill. Now, Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, said, quote, it's not that money buys votes, but you have a culture in which big money has significant influence. Big money gains you access. Access gives you the time to influence people, end quote. Well, Senator Sanders, I respectfully disagree. I think money does buy votes. This is America. If you can't buy it, it doesn't exist. Don't you understand that? Does anybody understand that? Write that down. That's an original for me. From me. And you can have it. If in America, in corporate America, I don't care what the product is. Sex, spirituality, a new car. Did you see the ad, the full-page ad in today's New York Times? Jesus, God. Which one of the auto manufacturers is it? Is it General Motors? They have a full-page ad. And it's about support the troops. Car dealers. And here's how you support the troops. You have a card you can fill in that says, I guess, I don't know, I'll have to get the ad during the next break. It says, I support the troops. And then you take it to your local GM or Chrysler Ford, I guess it's GM. You take it to your local car dealer. And you put it in a big box. And eventually, I guess, it's going to be sent to men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan who are dodging IEDs, and they're going to get this box full of these crappy-ass cards.
I support the troops.
Now, what's the real motive here? Is to get you into the dealership, right? This is stuff that just gives me that burning stomach acid that Prilosec doesn't do anything with. You know what I'm saying? This is infuriating. When I saw the ad today, I just went, oh no, oh God, please don't let this, no, it's really there, it's right in front of you. It was not a haint or a spirit or an illusion. There it is. Full page ad, New York Times. So, Senator Sanders, you know, I disagree with you. Money buys anything in this society, in a society like this, to the extent that if you can't buy it, it does not exist. The pharmaceutical companies spend more money on lobbying than any other single industry, even more than the energy companies. From 1998 to 2006, $855 million. That's according to the Nonpartisan Center for Public Integrity. That's almost $1 billion in lobbying. Now, what does that mean, lobbying? Doesn't that mean giving money to candidates? Doesn't it mean sending them on trips? Doesn't it mean trying to influence their soppy little brains to vote in favor of the pharmaceutical industry and not in favor of the pharmaceutical consumer? Ron Pollack, director of Families USA, which is described as a left-leaning consumer advocacy group, says, quote, I don't think there is any lobbying group in town, that would be D.C., that has the clout of the drug industry, end quote. Now, after this bill passed, it passed the Senate, it goes on to the House now. After it passed, the biggest drug trade group, some filthy organization called the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, dun, 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 praised the bill. The group spokesman, this industry trade group, which is a circle of whores, no disrespect to the sex industry, a circle of cheap whores. The spokesman for this circle of cheap whores, Ken Johnson, no disrespect to the sex industry, Ken Johnson said The critics, that would be people like you and me, who say, wait a minute, what the hell is going on? The critics, according to Ken Johnson, quote, never point out what a great deal of this money is spent, that a great deal of this money is spent trying to defeat bills that are designed to cripple this industry. Okay, I'll point it out. The money should be spent. If there's any money lying around to be used for lobbying, it should be to cripple the pharmaceutical lobbying industry. It should be used to make sure that these parasitic sons of bitches leave our elected representatives alone. Not that that would necessarily work, because our elected representatives would probably start beating the bushes looking for the money. Any pharmaceutical company reps over there? Hey, come over here. What you got? Hiya, step right up. Buy a piece of my ass and I'll vote for you. I'll vote for whatever you want me to do. You want me to make sure that that no test results are made public about your filthy drugs? I'll do it. Buy a piece of my ass. And I'm yours. I don't know. I just get tired of it. Don't you? Yeah, I know you do. I think I mentioned this last night, but it bears repeating. Jose Padilla, you know, the guy who was going to set off a nuclear bomb in where? Chicago, New York, Baltimore, Phoenix, I don't know. He was accused of being a dirty bomber. He was put in solitary confinement for 3 years in a Navy brig in South Carolina. He was charged as an enemy combatant, a made-up term that came out of the sick, drunk mind of George Bush and his thugs. He finally goes to trial in Miami, only they're not going to try him for anything like that. The scenario that federal prosecutors plan to present has nothing to do with all those accusations that were made by then-Attorney General John Ashcroft back in 2002. Oh, and Bush. Bush made the accusations, too. Jose Padilla, probably, in reality, is a former Chicago gang member who got his private parts caught in a ringer. The ringer being John Ashcroft. He was labeled as one of the most notorious terrorism suspects since the 9/11 attacks. But guess what? Somehow in the past 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, the prosecutors have decided that Jose Padilla is not really the guy they thought he was at all. Now, his attorneys say he's almost been reduced to somebody who's unable to defend himself. He's become schizophrenic, paranoid, delusional. Well, think about it. 3-4 years in solitary confinement. Huh? Could you handle that? I don't think I could. Instead, the prosecutors will lay out a more routine criminal case. They will say that Jose Padilla was a recruit to an alleged North American terrorist cell who conspired to support unspecified terrorist activities overseas. Wait a minute. I thought it was an American. I don't know. Sometimes, don't you feel like you just reached the absolute limit?
The new world order will hold these truths to be self-evident. Well, this is evident, yeah. In the American way, you must get and I shall take. I will tell you what is moral and what's just.
Feeling left out by right-wing talk radio? You found a home with Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. This Fadilla case also is another one of those aspects of the Bush crime family, things we've experienced in the past 7 years that are just beyond being an outrage. I can barely talk about these topics on the air or with people I know, because I just get crazy about those this stuff. Padilla has two co-defendants. One is a computer programmer from South Florida, and the other is a Detroit school administrator. Okay, these are the three people who have been charged. All have pleaded innocent. If they're convicted, they face up to life in prison. How would you like to be Padilla and know that you are not you are not responsible for what you were charged with? You were going to set off a nuclear dirty bomb in some American city, and now those charges have been dropped. They're not even being considered. Why is that? Well, Padilla was declared an enemy combatant by Bush and sent to the Navy brig in Charleston, South Carolina, where he was held without charges in solitary confinement for over 3 years. Think about that. Now, finally, his attorneys managed to get the case onto the docket of the United States Supreme Court. And the court was about to consider whether Padilla's detention violated his constitutional rights. And all of a sudden, the Bush crime family changes everything. He gets indicted in Miami and sent to a federal detention center there. All the stuff about a dirty bomb, all this psychopathic religious claptrap crap that came out of John Ashcroft's addled brain, what happened to that? It's all gone. Padilla has now served 5 years in prison, and he hasn't even been charged with anything that makes sense yet. A University of Miami law professor who filed a brief with the Supreme Court challenging Padilla's detention, I guess it would be an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, his name is Stephen Bladek, he said, the case is going to go out with more of a whimper than a bang. When you peel away all the layers, the actual case is circumstantial. The government's central argument is that Padilla is a bad guy who hung out with other bad guys. That's it. Now, also on the front page of the New York Times today, did you see it? The picture, and it's also at AOL.com, I think, on their welcome page, a picture of the guy freed after 19 years, DNA freed him. Byron Halsey. He was convicted of a horrific crime of raping and murdering two little children. He was convicted of raping and strangling a 7-year-old little girl and her brother, Tyrone. Tyrone died after four nails were hammered. He was eight. Four nails were hammered into his skull with a brick. The children's bodies were found in the basement of a rooming house in Plainfield, New Jersey, where Mr. Halsey lived with their mother. He denied any association with this crime. And finally, through DNA databasing evidence, they have found the person whose DNA matches it. Now, this is another one of the Innocent Project's cases. He was a factory worker. He was convicted back in 1988 of two counts of felony murder and sentenced to two life terms in 20 years. But he notified, or he got in touch with the Innocence Project, and he said, please, you know, I really am innocent. So the Innocence Project took on his case. And they found that, in fact, he was not guilty. There's this picture in the New York Times today. Here's the man sitting there, in handcuffs, with his attorney next to him, at a table, when the charges are all dismissed, and he's sitting there with tears coming down his face. The DNA evidence points instead, not to this guy, but to someone named Cliff Hall, a neighbor who testified against Mr. Halsey at the trial, and who is currently in prison himself for three sexual assaults. Yes, of course. Of course, if you want to know, Byron Halsey's a black man. Of course he is. What do you think, he's white? Padilla? Yeah, of course. Padilla is Latino. What do you think he is? White? This happens all the time, doesn't it? Well, how many cases is this now that the convictions that have been overturned as a result of DNA evidence, thanks to the Innocence Project? It's scores of them. Is it up to 200 yet? I think it's around 200 cases that have been proven. That have proven that the wrong man was convicted or the wrong woman was convicted. And it doesn't make, and what is galling about this is usually in these cases, the prosecutors still maintain in the face of DNA evidence, this is not circumstantial stuff. This is not a technicality. This is cold, hard, pure fact. This man did not commit the crime of which he was convicted. And he just barely missed getting a death sentence. This happened time and time again in Illinois. When I was in Illinois, we had three people who had been sentenced to death, who were in fact innocent, on the program. 201 wrongful convictions that have been overturned with the use of DNA evidence. And you know what is horrible about this? People in that group of 201 wrongly convicted, some of them had confessed or admitted to crimes they didn't commit. Halsey, for example, the guy I'm talking about, signed a confession after 30 hours of interrogation. I don't know. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Molloy. Stay with us. The hour. A couple of quick emails here from William in Hollywood. The subject about the money didn't influence them. The senators say, nah, you took a lot of money from the pharmaceutical industry. Had no influence on my vote at all. William writes, Mike, this is just another reason why I trust no politician. They continue to give us reasons not to. If the money was not an influence, then why did they take it in the first place? Sounds like we have nothing but the modernized version of The Sopranos walking the halls of the House and the Senate. William in Hollywood. John in Seattle writes, in the subject line, Mike, there is one little-known thing Bush did that is positive. That's in response to that challenge I have out there all the time. John writes, I hate pointing this out because I'm a huge critic of this administration, but Bush signed into law the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands Marine National Monument. The year, 2006, was highlighted by a presidential, this is from the website, the government website, was highlighted by a presidential proclamation designating the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands Marine National Monument. By doing so, the president has created the largest marine protected area in the world. Now, that's from the website, NOAA.gov website. John writes, it wasn't his project or anything like that, but he allowed it to happen. The average American we'll probably never know about this, but I thought I should point it out. I hate being fair. Sorry. No, I understand, John. But and while, yeah, okay, that one slipped through and Bush signed it into law. Probably because there's no, the ocean there is too deep. Isn't that the Pacific Trough, one of those deep troughs out there where the oil companies can't get near it? There might be a trillion, quadrillion barrels of oil 37 miles down, but they can't get to it. So it's no loss to Bush or his oil company handlers. But I'm going to hedge a little bit. I think your response here is a bit of a hedge. I said something that really directly affects all Americans in a positive way. Now, I understand what you're saying about the proclamation, but I don't think that rises to the standard or the lack of standards that I've put out there for this challenge on Bush. But, okay, I get the point. Now, the Padilla case, the reason that's in the news, of course, is because all of a sudden now he's going to go to trial on criminal charges brought by the government, not on charges that he is an enemy combatant about to blow up or permanently pollute with nuclear radiation one of our cities. We've been doing that to Iraq for 13 years. We did it to Kosovo. We have no problem, you see, with sending radioactive material into these foreign countries, depleted uranium. That's the metal of choice now in our weaponry, whether it's rocket casings, shell casings, no matter what it is, bullets even. So we have put enough radioactive pollution into Iraq to render that part of the Middle East just pretty much a hellhole of disease and death for the next 200,000 years. Think about that for a second. Oh, never mind. Why do we even think about it? So if anybody is polluting the planet with dirty bombs, it's us. We are. Hello. But Padilla, that was the original charge. He was going to come up with a dirty bomb, some conventional explosive surrounded by, nuclear waste, plutonium, whatever. And it was going to go off. And it was just going to just play hell. Literal hell in the city it went off. That was a charge against him. All of a sudden, that charge is evaporated. It's gone. So when is a terrorist not a terrorist, then? Eugene Robinson, writing in the Washington Post, points out that the Bush administration says that its zero tolerance policy against terrorism applies to all suspected evildoers, not just Muslims. Really? That's a lie. What about Luis Posada Carriles? Am I pronouncing that right? He's an accused terrorist who entered the United States illegally. He used to work for the U.S. military. He's a CIA asset, Posada. He entered the U.S. illegally. He was taken into custody by authorities. He was not kept in solitary confinement. He was not dragged out for occasional waterboarding. And now he's a free man. The guy is 79 years old. He has a long history of violent opposition to Castro's regime in Cuba. He has boasted of masterminding the 1976 mid-air bombing of a civilian Cuban airliner, a terrorist act that killed 73 innocent people, including, I think, members of the teenage members of Cuba's national fencing team. He boasted of it. He's also suspected of involvement in a 1997 series of bombings of hotels and nightclubs in Havana, Cuba. Several people were injured. An Italian tourist was killed. So, why is a man described by our government as, and this is how the Justice Department has described the son of a bitch, quote, an unrepentant criminal and admitted mastermind of terrorist plots and attacks on tourist sites, end quote. Why is he out, and why is he going to get a hero's welcome, or has gotten a hero's welcome in Miami from his old Bay of Pigs comrades? Well, in the first place, he sneaked into the country in 2005. And revealed that he was here because he held a news conference. Finally, after some jerking around, Homeland Security officials took him into custody. He was indicted in January on federal charges of immigration fraud for lying about how he entered the United States. But on Tuesday of this week, in Texas, where Posada has been held, a district judge down there dismissed the indictment, saying the government, the Bush crime family, had resorted to unconstitutional trickery in gathering his evidence against Posada. Unconstitutional trickery. The judge found that in Posada's formal immigration interview after the feds whisked him away in 2005, the government failed to provide adequate translation of the questions and answers. They didn't give him a good translator. Therefore, he can't be held. Can you believe this? The judge said that what the government contended, the Bush crime family contended, were lies about how he made his way into the United States look more like misunderstandings. Now, when I say the Bush crime family, they couldn't care less about Posada. The only reason he's a celebrity is because the Cubans in Miami, the anti-Castro Cuban community, and it's huge in Miami, look at this guy as a hero. Because he blew a Cuban jetliner out of the sky. The judge's point, though, the judge who released him, was that if the government, if the Bush crime family really wanted to keep this guy behind bars because he was a career terrorist, then prosecutors should have prosecuted him as a terrorist. And if they did that, then faster than you can say Patriot Act, the authorities could have made him disappear into the netherworld of indefinite detention. They could have sent him anywhere. Syria, you know, the people we don't talk to, but we outsource our torture. Egypt, Saudi Arabia. Yeah. Well, a grand jury in New Jersey reportedly is investigating this guy's alleged involvement in the Havana hotel bombings, and it's possible that someday he might face a new indictment. But not now. See, he's been released. He is a terrorist. He is a son of a bitch who is responsible for blowing an airliner out of the sky by his own admission. But he's released. He is a former intelligence operative and United States Army officer. Can you believe this? Now, the plane that blew out of the sky was on its way to Venezuela all those years ago. President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela said last week in Caracas, "We demand that they extradite that terrorist and murderer to Venezuela instead of protecting him." And Dagoberto Rodriguez Barrera, the chief of the Cuban intersection, that's Cuba's diplomatic representative in Washington, told the French news agency last week, quote, "Cuba forcefully condemns this decision and holds the government of the United States totally responsible for the fact that Posada Carriles is a free man in Miami." So, you know, when you hear this stuff about, well, you know, we're not going to tolerate terrorism anywhere, that's a lie. And you know it's a lie. It's a filthy lie. The Bush crime family being absolutely saturated with Christian fundamentalists are after the Muslim fundamentalists. And if the Jewish fundamentalists don't watch out, they're next.
Next best thing to an impeachment hearing, it's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
Well, that certainly is happy music, isn't it? And I think this is probably, you may have seen this, a senior lobbyist. This is kind of in keeping with the whole theme of the program tonight, which I guess is corruption. When is it not, right? A senior lobbyist at the National Association of Manufacturers, who has been nominated by Bush to, get this, he's going to head up the Consumer Product Safety Commission. He's going to get a $150,000 departing payment from the National Association of Manufacturers when he takes his new government job. What's his new government job? Enforcing consumer laws against members of the National Association of Manufacturers who have just giving him $150,000 and for whom he's been working for the past several years. The guy's name is Michael Baruti. He wrote recently to the Consumer Product Safety Commission's General Counsel that his severance pay of $150,000 was what is referred to as an extraordinary payment under a federal ethics rule. Now, what's that? Well, under the rule, a payment is extraordinary, quote, quote, if an employer, National Association of Manufacturers, grants it after learning that the employee, Michael Baroudi, is being considered for a government position and it is not part of an established compensation or benefits program. What? Mr. Baroudi said in the letter that the payment would not prevent him from considering matters involving individual companies that are members of the National Association of Manufacturers, many of whom are defendants in agency proceedings over defective products or have other business before the Consumer Product Safety Commission. You see how this works? Nor, he insists, would it preclude him from involvement with smaller trade groups like, oh, those representing makers of home appliances or children's products that might be defective and cause death and disfigurement. Oh, no, 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 I'll be fine. I can handle it. The chief lobbyist for the National Association of Manufacturers is nominated by George W. Bush to head the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which is involved in enforcing laws against the National Association. Oh, Jesus, God. It just never stops, does it? The nomination of Mr. Baroudi, who was the executive vice president of the National Association of Manufacturers, has provoked heavy criticism from Democrats and consumer groups. He is the latest in a line of industry officials and lobbyists to be given senior jobs by Mr. Bush at federal safety agencies that oversee matters like workplace safety, mine safety, transportation safety, drug safety, product safety. As the Bush administration has sought to roll back hundreds of regulations that businesses viewed as excessive. Businesses, not consumers, not your Aunt Mary, not your kid, who might wind up crippled for the rest of his or her life because of these sons of bitches don't care. They'll run anything down for sale. Remember, if you can't buy it, it doesn't exist. And I love the way the Times says, as a major trade organization for the largest companies in the country, the National Association of Manufacturers often has issues before the Consumer Product Safety Commission. It recently prevailed on the agency, for instance, to relax the requirements for when companies must notify the agency about defective products. Can you believe that? Huh? The National Association of Manufacturers convinced the Consumer Product Safety Commission to relax the requirements for when those companies have to notify the public about defective products. What, your child died? Oh, well, hold on a minute now. We don't want to get that out in the public yet. But let's wait till 7 or 10 or 20 children die, and then we'll talk about it. A spokesman for the White House, Emily Larimore, said the administration was satisfied. Excuse me. The Bush administration was satisfied that Mr. Baroudi, quote, has taken the steps necessary to avoid any conflict of interest in the event he is confirmed, end quote. And also, Ms. Larimore said that Mr. Baroudi's letter talking about his $150,000 departing bonus was approved by government ethics lawyers. What? In the Bush crime family? Ethics lawyers? Oh, for God's sake, give me a break. Ms. Larimore said, Mr. Baroudi has proven leadership abilities and over three decades of experience with labor policy, manufacturing, and safety issues, and we believe he will be a valuable advocate on behalf of American consumers. Oh, for Christ's sake. And they say that with a straight face, and you and I are supposed to sit back and go, right.
Woo!
go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you on Nova M Radio.
Yeah. Give it to Mikey. He doesn't like anything. Irish Dave writes in regarding Baruti. Mike, come on, give the crime family and their minions a little credit for audacity. Preemptive bribery. Yikes, Irish Dave. Yeah, well, that's right. 150 grand. Here you go. Here's 150 grand. Now, don't be influenced by the money. If one of our many cases, never mind. We haven't had any Foxy the Snowman for quite some time, mainly because we were off all last week. So we're back from vacation, and Tony's back from chemo. So let's or surgery. So let's bring Tony Snow on stage to give his non-answers again. This is from today's press briefing on the new war czar or fall guy. Take your pick. And isn't it interesting? They pick an active duty three-star general who is outranked by the very people he's going to have to. I still don't know what a war czar is going to do. The four-star generals who have retired, none of them would accept the job. They've all told Bush to go screw himself. So they get this guy, Lute. I love his name, General Lute. One thing I have to say about Lute, he was against the surge. He is not supportive completely of all of Bush's policies. So the fact that they picked General Lute raises a few eyebrows in Bush's inner crime circle. But here he is anyway. Now, the first reporter here, Martha, asked Tony the Snowman about the fabulous press that Lute has been receiving. She says, Tony, I noticed on one of your press releases today about Lieutenant General Lute that there are several quotes from General Petraeus saying how great Lute is. And also some quotes from Ambassador Crocker. Are these things? You have your press office solicit quotes from people, particularly someone in uniform. Do you do this to make positive comments about people you know?
I don't know, Martha, but it's clearly a burning issue, so we'll look into it for you.
Following up on Luke, he was skeptical about the president's surge pact. Do you know what changed his mind?
Again,
what did he do different that defense and state haven't been both trying to do in terms of troops on the ground and reconstruction and changing?
General Luke not only supports the way forward, but he also thinks that we're making progress, and now it is his job to work in a coordinating role, to try to look at everything that's going on under the auspices of the executive branch.
But
you're asking how is this, quote, different, and what you have now is somebody who's going to be able to coordinate with folks on the ground. Keep in mind also that he has experience both in Central Command and with the Joint Chiefs in operations, and therefore has a very keen sense of precisely how operations unfold, and therefore I think has a very practical base of knowledge about how to get things done, and also where the bottlenecks are, including information.
Oh, Jesus. I thought the decider, I thought the commander, I'm the commander. 4 years, 5 years, 4 years to come up with a war czar? Now, on the ongoing showdown between Congress and Bush on the funding of Bush's occupation and massacre in Iraq, this reporter says, on the war funding bill, Tony, Senator Levin this morning pulled down his proposal, which would have had timetables, but with presidential waivers. Why did the White House oppose that proposal? Where is the room for agreement between the president and Congress with that message and the predominant Democratic message of we're going to change the direction of this war?
The president actually has been changing the direction of the war for quite some time. You take a look at what has been going on, and we take a constant look at the facts on the ground. The most important thing to do is when you make changes, make sure they're based on the realities on the ground. When General Petraeus comes in, listen to what he has to say. It'd be useful to figure out what the facts are.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. When will we get the facts, Tony? Hey, the Republican candidates want to know this, too. They're trying to win an election with this war going on. They want to talk about the end of this, too. Uh-huh. What does he say the most important thing to do when you make changes is, quote, make sure they're based on the realities on the ground? When has any member of the Bush crime family looked at reality? Or John McCain, for that matter. Oh, my God. One more on the new war czar. Reporter wants to know why it took 5 years to figure out that this position was even needed. Now, it's typical of Snow Job. He doesn't have an answer. Nobody seems to know what this war czar is supposed to do that Gates and Bush and Cheney and Rice and Negroponte and Petraeus can't do. Huh? So the reporter says, why did it take so long, Tony? We're now in the fifth year of this war. Why did it take so long to come up with somebody of his seniority and stature? Do you think there is a new need and that you did not need someone to do this for all the previous years?
I don't know. I mean, I think what happened is, again, as you're taking a review, it became clear to us that this, as you move into a new phase of the war, keep in mind, we are still in the process of deploying people in this new way forward, as the president called it. I'm not going to try to, I don't know. It's... I don't have an answer for you. I'm telling you that's what he's here to do now.
What? What? Oh, God. All right, switching gears from the sublime to the ridiculous here regarding Wolfowitz. Wolfowitz. And his girlfriend and the World Bank scandal. The snowman defers yet again. I guess a reporter should ask the World Bank. You know, why are you asking Tony Snow, right? The reporter says, I know what you've been saying about Wolfowitz in the past, but it's gotten more serious overnight. Is the administration concerned at all that the World Bank loses further prestige, that it might lose money and influence while this continues to go on?
I really don't. I don't even know how to answer it because it's a notional question that is not something where I can think of a single metric that would be useful that would allow me to answer that question in a manner that I could defend.
Successor?
I'm not commenting on anything going on in terms of deliberations over the World Bank. I'd have you call them.
Well, I don't know how to answer it because it's a notional question. What the hell is a notional question? That is not something where I can think of a single metric that would be useful. A notional question, a metric. What language is he speaking?
He's speaking rumspeak.
Rumspeak.
That's rumspiratu speak.
Okay. You need to fix your microphone. You're crackling out here. One more on Wolfowitz. The reporter says, are you denying, Tony, then, that this administration is negotiating some kind of a deal for his departure? Are you denying that?
I'm not discussing it yay or nay. What I'm saying is, number one, we support Paul Wolfowitz. And number two, the issue of the day, which has to do with personnel, it is clear. He said he's made mistakes, but on the other hand, he in good faith made offers to try to recuse himself. He got what the World Bank itself admits is confusing guidance from people running the ethics. And therefore, it is certainly a mistake, but it is not a firing offense. And we stay by that. We also stand by our support of Paul as the World Bank president.
No, wait a minute. He got what the World Bank itself admits is confusing guidance from people running the ethics. What, you mean Paul Wolfowitz has to have someone tell him that it's not ethical to put your girlfriend on the on the payroll and then make sure she gets advances way ahead of her the normal advancement? Come on, for Christ's sake! But he stands there and says this, see? And we're supposed to go, oh yeah, well that's right, the ethics committee was confusing to poor Paul Wolfowitz. It's somebody else's fault his girlfriend got all those perks. Okay. And I love this part. Now, what is this about? This is about Paul Wolfowitz and his girlfriend Wolfowitz using his position to advance his girlfriend and getting a little in the process. I guess if you can imagine Wolfowitz naked, getting sex from Shaha Riza or whatever her name is, that staggers me. If you can imagine him having his comb licked or whatever they do, creep me out. Okay, now let's shift gears. Remember Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky? Okay, now you know he got his comb licked too, or was it his cigar? I don't know. Nobody knows. But get what Tony Snow says here. It's a mistake, but it's not a firing offense. But they tried to fire Clinton because he had a girlfriend, right? And I don't remember Clinton putting his girlfriend on the payroll. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. My mistake. These are Republicans. These are neoconservatives. These are lying sons of bitches on the right, and they can do anything they want. If they work in media, they can do drugs until they go deaf. They can send their cleaning lady out to score street drugs for them and still get off. If they run the Defense Department, they can commit our troops to a war in which our troops are going to get slaughtered and then make snotty comments like, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you want to. Blah, 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 blah. It's pretty incredible. It's not a firing offense. I would say something about putting your hoe on the payroll, but you know, I don't want to do that because I try not to use that kind of language where it concerns an obviously well-trained woman who happens to be boinking Paul Wolfowitz. Oh, stop. There goes the gag reflex again.
Not and will not allow the world's worst leaders to hold the United States and our friends and allies blackmail.
Oh, you twit. Oh, my God. 10 before the hour. What's this? A call from Sydney, Australia. John is calling from Sydney. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, mate, how are you?
I'm doing fine. So you're calling me from Thursday, aren't you?
Yes, that would be right. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say I'm always impressed when I get a call from the future.
And no, I don't have the horse race results.
Ah, damn. All right.
But I wanted to give you a warning. I know you all have a real love for Australian wines.
And yes, yes.
You stock up. The crush, because of the drought that's been striking us for the past 5 years.
Right.
The crush is down by over 30% this year, and Australian wine prices are getting ready to skyrocket.
Oh, that's a shame, because aside from the fact that it's excellent wine, the prices, I don't know how the prices on Australian wines, mid-price wines, can be so inexpensive here in the States. I don't know how they do it, but... So the drought, what's going to happen to Australia? It's my understanding the place is going to catch fire and just burn up.
Well, we had a really bad season this year. A huge section of Victoria, as opposed to having, you know, a fire break out for a matter of a couple of weeks and then die down, it basically burned for the entire season. Most three states have gone to are at level 4 water restrictions. The aquifers are down to way under 30%, some are under 20%, and the squabbles between state and federal governments here, they've not done anything about it, and they're now looking at desalination plants which is a really bad move. But it's gotten to the point that it's so bad that they may have no choice, because it's the fastest way to get another water source in place. But it's pretty horrific. They're looking, they're investing a lot of money preparing for the suicide rates with the farmers to go right through the roof.
Oh my
God. Because it's bad. I used to, when I was touring with bands around this country, and you drive out and through the bush, you drive by these farms, and just over the last couple of years, it's turned into an absolute dust bowl. Cattle are being sold off for like pennies a head.
Oh my
it's,
God.
and you know, it's been really kind of a frightening situation here, and it's not going to get any better. You know, as you probably know, I'm very involved in environmental issues,
right?
And they all science says that Australia is going to be hit first and worst by global warming, and I've just seen the weather patterns here get to be absolutely atrocious in just the 10 years that I've been in this country. It's been an absolutely tangible change year to year. We ran probably temperatures this past summer here in Sydney where right inside my house was breaking 120 degrees Fahrenheit for almost 4 weeks solid.
Oh my God.
You know, it's pretty harsh. But on another subject, we have the APEC summit coming,
right,
here in Sydney, and the security precautions that are being taken because Bush is coming to town,
right,
are absolutely ridiculous. They're closing down most of the inner city railway stations for 3 days solid.
Now, APEC, what organization is that? I'm drawing a blank, John.
This is the Asia-Pacific Economic Conference.
Oh, okay. All right. Right.
And so this is something that you wouldn't see so much in the States. But, however, Bush is going to be here, and hovering over his motorcade wherever he is in Sydney is going to be a chopper with cellular phone jamming technology.
Oh, Jesus.
And most public areas, including our national icon, the Sydney Opera House, is going to be cordoned off for 10 days from the public. And they've even called an extra public holiday on the Friday just because.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're just going to shut down business, and this is supposed to be a pro-business convention.
You know, this Bush, George Bush, has got to be the most, at the same time, feared and fearful human being in a position of power on the globe. Every place he goes, they just lock the country down. I don't care what country it is. It doesn't matter what hemisphere it's in. It doesn't matter if it's predominantly English-speaking or predominantly some other language. Every place this miserable son of a bitch goes, everything has to stop. This defines a coward. And it defines the kind of ugly presence that this man takes with him no matter where he goes. It's astonishing, John. I've never seen anything like this in my life.
The deputy premier of New South Wales, when the announcement came that this thing was going to be held in Sydney, you know, he was just completely up in arms and said, look, this brings no benefit to the city of Sydney. And why are we not holding this thing in the national capital of Canberra, which would make a whole lot more sense because it's not in the middle of any financial district. It's out kind of in the middle of nowhere. It would make so much more sense.
Yeah.
But this will be the second time that they have actually cordoned off the Opera House. This is the thing that just on principle drives me absolutely insane.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, you know, the most iconic building in the country will be cordoned off for blocks.
Yeah.
From the public.
It's incredible. John, how's 12th Harmonic coming?
I tell you what, with the radio project, we don't get too much happening over there. I'm going to start making a conscious effort to getting some things happening over there.
All right, there's the music. Let me just remind people, you still have a program at headonradio.com, right?
Yes, sir, I do. Headonradionetwork.com. Sure do. It's called Foxed Up.
All right. John, good to hear from you. Take care. We got a boogie. We'll talk.
You too, man. Thanks.
All right. We'll talk again, John. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It's about 7 past the hour. That last call from Australia, from Sydney, was from John Fox, who is one of the program hosts and developers, I think, of Head On Radio, the Head On Radio Network. If you haven't gone to their website, if you haven't listened to their network, shame on you. You really have to do this. I mean, you have to. I'm so impressed. It's Head On, like Head On Collision, headonradionetwork.com. These guys are scattered from Florida to West Virginia to Australia, and this internet broadcasting that they've put together, as far as I know, I don't know, Kathy, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it's the only international, on this level, international radio network, you know, where the talent is scattered in two hemispheres, and John always comes from the future. But if you haven't been there, it's headonradionetwork.com. They have some good talent there, and I think it's a network that should be listened to. I realize I work for Nova M Radio Network, and this other one is Head On Radio Network. Oh, wow, conflict. No, bat squeeze. Listen to them. Check them out. Even if you want to listen during my program, go ahead. Talent is talent, and I think these guys do a hell of a job. Headonradionetwork.com. Please just check them out. You make your own decision, but give them a listen. Okay, not during my program. All right, let's do some phone calls. Coming up in about 20 minutes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to start this. I'm going to read one every night. There's 11 of them. Essays about the corruption, how 8 years of Bush, 8 years of sabotage, bungling, and neglect, how to repair it. And it's eight very short essays written, or 11 very short essays, I think, written by some very good writers. Okay? But right now, let's do some phone calls. The number here is 800-989-1480. And John, if you're still listening, I have a glass of Wolf Blass, Cabernet Shiraz, here in the final hour of the program. Excuse me. And the only reason I'm drinking wine is because I've developed some kind of laryngitis. Too much fun at the beach. So this kind of eases the vocal cords, yes?
Denial.
What, denial? All right, here we go to your phone calls. Let's start with John, who's calling from Oregon. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, here I am, and you start out with the pharmaceutical companies, and I had... On Free Speech TV, they talked about 150,000 Americans die per year because of having the wrong drug.
Yeah, right.
And 1.5 million are hospitalized because of a prescription problem.
Right.
And so... We have a big lobby here, whether it's pharmaceuticals or, pick your topic. We have, 25,000 lobbyists in Washington, and we got to turn that around.
Well, I hear you. I really do. I just don't see how... under our present system, John, we'll ever turn it around. This country is run by corporations.
Mm-hmm.
The corporations pretty much own 90% of 75% of the Democratic Party. They own 100% of the Republican Party. I don't know how to turn it around. I sometimes think the only way that it's going to be turned around is fulfilling what Thomas Jefferson said, and that is simply that the tree of liberty has to be fed every once in a while with the blood of patriots and tyrants. So, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. But
yeah.
I'm just not very optimistic that we're going to get through this without some kind of upheaval at some point. Corporate America has got to get its filthy fingers out of the system of governance that we have tried for 230 years to implement in this country. They've got to get out of it.
Yeah.
And they're not going to go willingly. Corporate America hates freedom, it hates democracy, it hates representative government because they can't control it. So they're doing everything they possibly can to destroy it and replace it with the kind of fascism that Mussolini was so fond of.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's got to stop. John, I got to move on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, appreciate you
Bye.
Checking in. Take care. Bill is calling from Paso Robles, California. Hey, Bill.
Yeah, hi, Mike. Something that's sort of been eating at me for a while. I've heard along through the grapevine, sort of between Tom Hartman and John Elliott, let's say, that Gore is probably not going to run, and you know that leaves you know the corporate
right.
free, or if you include Richardson, somewhere you know off to the side of the corporate stable. Just wondering if you spend a minute, you know, giving your take on the race, sans Gore.
What Gore?
You know, sans. You know, that's French for
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I just didn't. I didn't understand the first word. Sans Gore.
Yeah, you know, without Gore.
Song Gore.
Song Gore.
All right. Now, what do you want me to say?
Just if Gore doesn't run, you know, how do you see the race at the, at this distant point?
I have no earthly idea. I just can't get any kind of an idea, Bill, about who is going to emerge from the Democratic pack or the Republican pack. I know everybody is saying Hillary is going to. Hillary is going to be the candidate. It's a done deal. It's a foregone conclusion. It's a fait accompli. Yada yada yada. I don't know. I can't.
Can I throw in one more question?
Sure.
Let you go. Do you think that Bill Clinton could pull it off for his wife? And I'll leave it at that. And you know, it's great talking to you.
All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you checking in, Bill. All right. Take care. I think Bill Clinton is nothing but an asset for Hillary. And whatever he can do, I think he's trying to do for her. Whether you like Bill Clinton or not, and I didn't particularly. I thought, you know, I've said it so many times. I think there were a number of things that he did well. But he's not a liberal, and he's not a Democrat. He's something else. Don't ask me. I have no idea what he is. I do know this, that for 8 years of Bill Clinton, whereas our military killed an awful lot of people in Central Europe and in Iraq, we didn't lose anybody. So I guess that's a plus, right? Bill Clinton is nothing but an asset because the evil men do lives after them, while the good is often tarred with their bones. Remember that bit? What's that from Julius Caesar? With Clinton, it's just the opposite, I think. I think people remember Clinton as somebody who presided over a prosperous and peaceful America, even though, once again, our vision in this country is so myopic, we can't see beyond our own borders. We don't know what's going on in our name around the world. And sometimes that's probably a blessing, because if we did know what was going on around the world in our name, we'd all go mad. But Clinton, Bill Clinton, that's the memory of Bill Clinton, except for the psychopaths in this country who all they wanted to do is see Bill Clinton's penis and they would have been happy, and they never got to see it. So they're just furious with literal penis envy and literal penis envy. Every single Republican male member of Congress who is in power or in office during the time of the Clinton administration, desperately, desperately wanted to see Bill Clinton's penis so they could compare and contrast, and then they would have been happy. And they almost got a court order, remember, to take a look at Bill Clinton's penis, but just couldn't do it. So the engorged rage that most Republicans feel about Bill Clinton is still there because they couldn't see his penis. As far as how that will affect the Hillary vote, you know, Republicans don't vote Democratic anyway. So the long answer to your question, I'm sorry, Bill, for all the chattering here. But, yeah, Bill Clinton will be an asset to Hillary. Will she get elected? I'm sorry to say this, but this is America 2007, and America 2007 will not elect a woman.
Here in Washington, we're now determining the size and the shape of a package. It's not if we have a package, it's how big will the package be.
Yeah. Kangaroo Brisbane sent me an email from Down Under 2, referencing Bush is not feared, he's hated. Thanks, Rue. And again, I've got to say it again. I'm not trying to push too hard here, but check out headonradionetwork.com. I'm telling you, check it out. Back to your phone calls. Robert is calling from Daly City, California. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Mike.
How you
doing?
Great
to hear you again. I really enjoyed Jeff on there. He's a great substitute for you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and Peter Werby, when you had him on years ago. Listen, this health care plan a lot of folks want to get for the United States, we need to take a close look at what's going on in Germany, where by law the doctors have to disclose alternative means and therapies, because doctors and naturopaths that try to help people here are under the sword here as far as doing something that they know would be helpful, but it's not legal.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like you say, they write the laws. Well, they're a big, great big monopoly,
right.
And they block alternatives. It'd be good. I mean, what really incenses me is they take these little one-year-old kids and give them these psychotropic drugs because they say they've got attention deficit disorder. Then you find out doctors are getting these great big promotions, bribes, basically. I mean, that's obscene. It's totally obscene.
It is. Robert, if you're on a cell, it keeps cutting out, and we're missing some of what you're saying. I think we have...
Is that any better?
A little bit. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, so there's that, and we need the health care freedom if we're going to have this universal health care, and I'm convinced that it'll put these guys out of business, because there's been a lot of suppression. I've said it before that... the war on drugs, the war on cancer, the war on terror, they're all great big scams.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think another thing that's happening, corporate America is facing a schism here, not unlike a religious schism within a church. And it's all based on health care. Corporate America has been the primary provider of health care to workers in this country for a number of years, and they could no longer, they just simply can't afford it because their buddies in the pharmaceutical and the healthcare industry are charging outlandish, exorbitant, obscene rates for medicines, for treatments, for hospitalizations. It's just unbelievable. The privatization of healthcare in this country has resulted in fraud and scam and scheme, one after another, death, injury, destruction. It just goes on and on. But corporate America, other than the healthcare industry, they're starting to realize they can't do this anymore. What did I read the other day? The average price of the average car carries with it a $1,500 tariff for healthcare. That's, for the employees. If you buy a Ford Motor product, for example, you're paying $1,500 more than you should have to pay for the car in order for Ford Motor to provide health care for their employees. It's got to come to the point. It must come to the point where we have single-payer health care in this country, a federalized health care like Medicare that anyone can buy into. That does not restrict your choice of doctors. That's what these sons of bitches in the healthcare industry try to tell you. That's what they did with the Harry and Louise ads back in 1993 when the Clinton administration was trying to get single-payer health care here. Just confusing America, making it all look like it's going to be horrible. You'll have to wait 6 months for an emergency appendectomy and all this other crap. When Americans finally wake up to the point that we understand that we rank 16th or 17th or 25th or whatever where it concerns health care and health in general in this country, on this planet, then maybe something will get done. In the meantime, these huge capitalistic consortiums, whether it's hospital companies or insurance companies or pharmaceutical companies, they're going to continue to gouge and rip and cheat and steal until hell freezes over, because Congress won't stop them and the American public doesn't think, we don't think we can.
Yeah, well, free enterprise is really the way, and that's all, like I think of Ron Paul or Dennis Kucinich, these people, that's all we're really asking for is free enterprise. If we have free enterprise, we can turn this thing on its head.
Well, free enterprise has never really been free, and where it concerns health care, it's got to be single payer. It's got to be through the government. Robert, I got to leave it there. Thanks a lot, pal. I appreciate you checking in. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us.
Everything is crumbling around me. Why does everything cost so much money? Could somebody please help out my family? My mom needs hearing aids, new shoulders and new legs. My dad needs a break, he works all day every day. My brother needs a place and a job where he can make enough money to take care of his baby. Here's a simple...
Go gently into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
26 before the hour, as Harper's Magazine says, George W. Bush has taken a prosperous nation and mired it in war, replaced our national composure with terror, and left behind him a legacy of damage so profound that repairing it will likely be the work of generations. Before the next administration can return to solving the already considerable problems the nation faced in 2000, it must begin to correct the misdeeds and missteps of the current one. To that end, Harper's Magazine has assembled a group of journalists and thinkers to survey the damage. And we are going to read these essays starting right now, one a night. This is by David Cole. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. No one has captured George W. Bush's understanding of constitutional law more precisely or presciently than Richard M. Nixon, who famously and incorrectly told David Frost in 1977, quote, when the president does it, that means it's not legal, end quote. Many hoped this theory had seen its definitive demise with Nixon's own fall, but Bush and his compatriots clearly have a different view. Dick Cheney in particular has long argued that his old boss's forced resignation set the stage for an unwarranted evisceration of executive power. We should not be surprised, then, that Cheney and his new boss, with the help of a color-coded state of fear induced by the terrorist attacks of 9/11, have done much to restore the Nixonian tradition. As a result, the Constitution at the end of Bush's two terms is much the worse for wear. For a short parlor game, challenge your friends to name a constitutional right that Bush has not sought to undermine. The First Amendment right of association, for starters, has been rendered virtually meaningless by the Bush administration, which shortly after 9/11 issued an executive order authorizing the freezing of all assets of any person or entity the Treasury Department deemed, quote, otherwise associated, unquote, with anyone the administration deemed a terrorist, regardless of whether the individual had engaged in terrorist activity of any kind. The administration also has argued that foreign nationals coerced at gunpoint to provide food to guerrilla groups abroad should be denied entry to the United States for providing, quote, material support, end quote, to terrorists. Similarly, our Fourth Amendment rights to privacy have been infringed by vastly expanded surveillance authorities under the USA Patriot Act, drafted by the administration and pushed through Congress in the weeks after 9/11. Most recently, the Justice Department's own Inspector General found pervasive misuse of, quote, national security letters, end quote, a form of administrative subpoena whose reach the Patriot Act dramatically expanded. The FBI used the letters to demand personal information on more than 143,000 occasions over a three-year period, used them in circumstances not authorized even by the Patriot Act, and systematically underreported that use. The Fifth Amendment right to due process, meanwhile, has fallen victim to assertions that, quote, enemy combatants, end quote, can be held indefinitely without trial, that suspicious organizations can have their assets frozen without notice or hearings, and that military tribunals can sentence defendants to death on the basis of hearsay and coerced, tortured testimony. For the administration, secrecy trumps all legal process. It has claimed that lawsuits challenging unconstitutional renditions to torture and warrantless wiretapping cannot even be adjudicated because the government's allegedly unconstitutional conduct is itself a secret, even when the facts in question have already been emblazoned across the pages of the country's newspapers. The single constitutional principle most under attack, however, is the separation of powers. Time and again, administration officials have sought to elevate the president above the law, arguing that, as commander-in-chief, he may choose to engage the enemy however he pleases, without regard to what the other branches of government have said. This notion first surfaced in an August 2002 Justice Department memo, written by Deputy Assistant Attorney General John Yoo for then White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez. You argue that the president could not be precluded from ordering the torture of enemy combatants merely because the United States had ratified an international treaty prohibiting torture under all circumstances, or because Congress had made torture a federal crime. Quote, the president enjoys complete discretion in the exercise of his commander-in-chief authority and in conducting operations against hostile forces, end quote, John Yoo wrote. He further wrote, quote, Congress can no more interfere with the president's conduct of the interrogation of enemy combatants than it can dictate strategic or tactical decisions on the battlefield, end quote. If the president decided to engage the enemy by ordering that the enemy be tortured, that was his prerogative, and literally nobody could stop him. The administration made the same basic argument in 2004, this time in front of the Supreme Court. In Rasul versus Bush, the administration argued that the president's power as commander-in-chief barred Congress and the courts from exercising any oversight over his decisions to detain hundreds of foreign nationals at Guantanamo. In similar cases involving U.S. citizens Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla, the administration maintained that the courts could not question the president's factual determination that they were enemy combatants. The president advanced this commander-in-chief knows best argument still a third time in defending his decision to secretly authorize the National Security Agency to wiretap Americans without probable cause or judicial oversight, and in direct contravention of a federal statute that makes warrantless wiretapping a crime. In a sign that Nixon's theory of constitutional law still has limited appeal, the administration was rebuffed on each of these assertions. The Justice Department retracted the torture memo after it disclosed its disclosure sparked widespread condemnation and released a new memo shortly before Gonzalez's confirmation hearings for Attorney General that omitted the section on the president's power to ignore criminal and international law. In the Guantanamo case, the entire court rejected Bush's claim that Congress and the courts could play no role in reviewing the legality of Guantanamo detentions. In the Hamdi case, Sandra Day O'Connor wrote for the majority that, quote, whatever power the United States Constitution envisions for the executive in its exchanges with other nations or with enemy organizations in times of conflict, it most assuredly envisions a role for all three branches when individual liberties are at stake, end quote. And in August 2006, a federal court declared the NSA spying program unconstitutional, rejecting the president's assertion of uncheckable authority with the stern warning that there are no hereditary kings in America. Excuse me. While the courts have to some extent stood up to the president, Congress has generally caved, most notably in passing the USA Patriot Act, and in 2006, the Military Commissions Act, which insulated military tribunals from any challenge that they violate the Geneva Conventions, watered down the criminal prohibitions on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and revoked habeas corpus rights for enemy combatants. Restoring the Constitution will be a monumental task, but doing so is critical to maintaining the character of our democracy. terrorism does not pose an existential threat to the United States in the traditional meaning of that term. The nation's sovereignty is not seriously threatened by Al-Qaeda. But in a more subtle sense, terrorism does precisely that threat, or poses precisely that threat. We cannot destroy the Constitution in order to save the country, because the Constitution is the country. The first and most important step toward restoration of constitutional principle, then, will be the next election. If the public does not demand fidelity, wow, excuse me, fidelity to our founding principles, our representatives will not do so on their own. The remaining steps are straightforward. The next administration could start by proclaiming loudly that in wartime, as in peacetime, the American system of government includes three branches, and the president's first job is to take care that the law is faithfully executed. Second, Guantanamo must be shut down, and the prisoners there brought within our borders. When Defense Secretary Robert Gates suggested just that, the administration's lawyers objected that they would lose their arguments that because the detainees are held offshore, they are unprotected by the Constitution. But the argument that Guantanamo is a law-free zone is precisely why that issue has become a world symbol for U.S. arrogance and lawlessness, a reverse Statue of Liberty, as some have called it. Finally, if we are to avoid a repeat of the McCarthy era's guilt by association tactics, Congress should amend the material support laws by requiring proof that an individual's support was intended to further terrorist activity and ensuring that blacklisted groups have a meaningful opportunity to defend themselves. These measures should be important first steps in restoring not only the Constitution, but the United States' standing in the world. If we do so, we might have some chance of stemming the tide of anti-Americanism that is the single greatest threat to our security in the decades ahead. And I apologize for the coughing. Like I said, I picked up some kind of bronchitis. When we were on vacation, we were not far away from those fires in Central Florida. Dahlia Lithwick is the senior editor at Slate. Tomorrow we'll do her essay, The Courts, how the Bush crime family has totally perverted the courts. The third essay is on civil service. The fourth is on the environment. The fifth is on science. The sixth is on the economy. Then comes the marketplace of ideas, intelligence, the military, diplomacy, and the national character. Those are the 11 that we're going to be reading on the air. You can find them all at the Harper's Magazine, June 2007 issue. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us.
Alpha male, alpha male, alpha male. Mass destruction. Mass destruction. Mass destruction. Alpha male, alpha male, alpha male, alpha male, alpha male. I come from Texas. Texas. Texas, 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 Texas. I come from Texas. Texas. Texas, 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 Texas. The new Prime Minister of India is, no. Mass destruction. Mass destruction. Mass destruction. Mass destruction. Mass destruction.
It's about 9 before the hour. Man, I apologize for that coughing spasm. Wow. Thanks to Ian Huff, who engineered the program at our flagship station in Phoenix, KPHX. He also answered your calls. Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, Mark Marshall, our webmaster, the moderators at MikeMolloy.com on the message board, and also Catherine Bay, who is our executive producer. You know, I keep hearing these commercials or promos, whatever you want to call them, on our station here, our network here, about signing up for downloads and podcasts. Become a founding member of NovaMRadio.com. And once we hit 5,000, is it 5,000, Kathy? 5,000 founding members, there's going to be a drawing for 10 grand. And we've been talking about this for, what, 3 months now? And we haven't hit that yet? Good God! Okay, well, if that's the way it is, I guess that's the way it is. But I would strongly recommend that, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is this drawing, but also for the what you get from becoming a founding member. And again, I'll drop a little teaser into it. We have some changes coming at this network that's going to blow you away. I just simply can't go beyond that. Kathy's looking at me like, shut up. There are some things going to happen at this network that you're going to be stunned, and I wouldn't tell you that if it weren't the truth. So if you haven't yet, again, I strongly recommend that you go to NovaMRadio.com and become a founding member. And when the things I'm talking about come to pass, you'll say, damn, Malloy was right. Whoa. Back to your phone calls. Lon is calling from Miami. Hey, Lon, welcome to the program.
Yes, good evening, Mike.
Hey.
You were talking earlier about the Chrysler problem. I believe they call that with the timeline for our free enterprise, the oligopoly stages of capitalism. And then the paramilitaries, I had a vision. That's what I'm calling.
Yeah.
I believe New Orleans is going to be the staging area for the paramilitaries in Iraq that are training right now. They're just trying to get experience and raise their PTSD level so they can come over here and get things organized. You know, just before Hurricane Katrina and Wilma, the President Bush, he had started up the citizens' council. He was going to put together through the JCs. Are you familiar with that at all?
I'm not. The old white citizens' councils in the South, I'm real familiar with. Yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, no. It was something new. It was something new. It was in April, just before the hurricane.
Yeah.
And so...
No, I'm not familiar with that. I'm not familiar with that at all.
Yeah, he was trying to just about mandate for the Junior Chamber of Commerce to come in there after they timelined FEMA out of the
yeah, and what was supposed to happen?
Control, you know?
What was supposed to happen then?
Well, he was trying to figure out how to get them to step in at FEMA's place.
Junior Chamber of Commerce?
Yeah, the JCs. It's a worldwide organization.
Yeah, well, I'm familiar who they are, but what?
It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. So I wanted to see
What were they going to do? They were going to come in and bully everybody in New Orleans?
No. They get involved with community activity. They go help out with hurricanes, stuff like that, okay?
Okay.
But what happened was that I don't think they really took it in the right way, because when I looked at the website, hardly any chapters got involved. Because I think Bush had some other ideas to make it a political organization and get control of it.
Yeah,
like
the internal
Volunteers of America
type
organization.
Yeah.
But the paramilitaries are on their way. And you're absolutely right. It's going to be like Jefferson said. And tonight we should launch the official May 17th group and get things organized.
Oh, my God, that sounds so communist, the May 17th group. All right, I hear you loud.
One more thing.
Yeah, quick.
On essays, you need one on the General Welfare Clause, because we have all our Bill of Rights, and the General Welfare Clause are usually in when cities incorporate.
Yeah.
And that's how we protect our rights against the government. And the government, if they need a new law or a code or ordinance and they haven't passed it, they use that. And the last time it was used in Atlanta. We found a case in 1912, went to the Supreme Court in 1914. That's how far back it goes in its usefulness, because very few people even know about it.
Yeah, well, I certainly don't. You've opened up a whole new area that now I have to go research.
It's absolutely unbelievable because that's how we protect ourselves from government, and it's provided in the incorporation paperwork when cities incorporate. And also, it's a way where a city, if they're lacking a code or an ordinance, they can use that for the general welfare clause.
All right, you've given me my homework assignment for tomorrow. Thanks, Lon. I appreciate it. We're out of here, Truth Seekers. We'll see you tomorrow night. Okay, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network.